You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. We're about to travel across the globe and say hi to Tom Roberts of the National Catholic Reporter in the United States. Tom, welcome to Sunday Night.
Hello, John. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you back with us. As so often occurs in the Catholic world, things are connected. We've just had a discussion about a proposal by a group of Australians to raise some pressure regarding the bishop's ad limina visit to Rome in a month or so, and a grassroots petition to have some form of lay input into the process, or at least the voice of the people as they see it being heard. Is this reflected in the sorts of news the NCR is carrying about the United States and other countries?
Well, I think there are rumblings all around, people trying to effect change and take a voice in some of these issues. In the big picture, I think what we're seeing is the realization of people, especially in Western cultures, and talking about Europe and the United States and Australia, realizations that we're facing a crisis, both in our ecclesiology, there aren't enough priests, and around some issues that the laity feel very strongly about. I quite frankly don't know how this all comes out in the end, but people are gathering their voices in different ways and trying to have some impact on these things. There is a petition that's begun by a group called Future Church in the United States. I think they posted it about 3 weeks ago. They have, I think, 1,500 signatures, which really aren't great numbers. But they're essentially asking the same thing, and it's focused on this whole question of, are we going to be a Eucharistic community? Can we save communities? What is ordination about? Can we broaden the conversation about who can be ordained? And questions of authority and all that sort of thing. So there's a common conversation going on in a number of places, I think.
Is it also linked to another issue that's emerging, and particularly in the United States, the NCR have alluded to it, that is the way in which over the last 40 or 50 years, theologians have increasingly become lay theologians, and the old dominance of clerical theology has disappeared. So you're getting a gulf opening up between the thinkers of the church and the administrators of the church.
Very recently, what we did was look at the associations here of theologians and talk to one priest, who elderly fellow who had been around for a long time, and he made the observation that, you know, this used to be all priests. We used to get dinner with bishops and get together with them and that sort of thing. And now it's all lay people. And those lay people are not only at Catholic institutions. And some of them take off to secular institutions and state universities and other sorts precisely to avoid the sanctions of a bishop and a bishop's control over a Catholic university. I think in the United States, there's been a real tension between bishops and theologians. As early as 1989, 91, they were working out in the conference how to deal with theologians. I think they really haven't worked that out very well. And in the case of Elizabeth Johnson, a theologian here who wrote a very, very popular book called The Quest for God, is a case in point. She was recently severely criticized by the Bishop's Doctrine Committee here. And that precipitated a rather lively back and forth between Johnson and the bishops and theologians here in two different groups and the bishops.
That was strangely resonant of an issue here some years ago with Paul Collins, a former colleague here at the ABC and then priest, over his writings. And it was as much about the process as it was about the outcome. That is, there was a feeling, both I see it in Johnson's writings and commentary and from Paul Collins, that the process engaged in by the church almost excluded them from having a voice. So the process it wasn't only about the outcome being unjust, it was about the process being utterly non-transparent.
Precisely, and it wasn't just almost not having a voice. She did not have a voice. She learned about it from her bishop. There was no communication at all with her. No chance to discuss the committee's interpretation of this, and it was pretty much slammed on her. She was, I think, largely blindsided by the critique. But she answered in a rather powerful and lengthy response to the bishops. She also got very, very strong support from two major theological societies in the United States. And I must say, to the benefit of her bishop, I think, and that is Archbishop Bishop Dolan of New York, he went to see her in her offices, and I think they had, you know, a good exchange and came to some understanding that was different from the stark reality of that, you know, the initial critique.
One of the interesting things, too, about this book is that it seems that she is critical of the bishop's process, not only because of the way it was done, but because of the lack of expertise involved in critiquing her work. She points out in her defense that those making the accusations against her clearly misunderstand her intent and even understand the conceptual framework in which she's operating. That is, they just got it wrong from the start.
That's one of her central points she makes, is that you just don't understand the book, you don't get it, you've got some things just absolutely wrong. And as I understand it, the work on this was done mostly by a priest named Juan Andy, who I think is fairly conservative, does not have, I think, a great liking for the disposition of theologians like Johnson, who will push the limits and explore different meanings and understandings of God. But the other thing that comes clear in this is that the theological community, I mean, huge numbers of them, are using this book. They're using the book in classes and discussions at the university level. So the sort of the indictment is of the whole theological community. And to do that without any reference to the theologian herself, without any discussion or any back and forth with even the theological community, it's just an old way of expressing authority. And I think it is indicative of a bigger problem we're seeing in the United States. I don't mean to go too far afield here, but it is part of the same problem, and that is this. I think that the bishops in the United States are facing a drain of their authority and credibility, not only within the church, but in the wider culture. And these kinds of moves to bring down the heavy hammer on someone and say, we can still say what's right and wrong and what you should read and not read, are expressions of a culture that is, I think, really at sea in trying to figure out how to reestablish itself.
It's a very interesting response to that, too, in what we see in the Australian document. The Australian document is calling for the church to be outward directed. This seems to be the underlying current here in the concerns in the United States, too. The church is moving into a defensive clerical mode in its authority structures, when those who want to see the church move forward are saying, no, you're getting it wrong. You're adopting a final remnant, a faithful remnant view, when really, if you're going to survive, you actually need to be committed and engaged with the culture rather than standing as a faithful remnant against it.
That's one of, I think, the fundamental tensions in just a, you know, worldview, a view of the church. The other is here a tension between that view and reasserting authority. And, of course, that's complicated here by the ongoing sex abuse crisis and the hierarchies dealing with it. But also with the tension is between the hierarchy and the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is there are still a lot of people going to church here. There are big parishes, and most of the work and increasing amounts of the work being done by lay people and schooled ministers, people schooled in ministry. You know, and I would dare venture that if the lay ministers in the United States decided to take a Sunday off, not much would happen in churches.
And it's increasingly similar in countries such as Australia. You mentioned the sex abuse crisis too. We need to canvass that one. It seems a perennial. You've had a linked issue in the United States where you've had, and it's made news here, two Catholic, largely Catholic jurisdictions, New York and Rhode Island, pass gay marriage laws and civil union provisions for gays and lesbians. But in one of those areas, and I think Kansas City in Missouri, there was a bishop who was warned a year ago about a priest who eventually was arrested for possession of child pornography. And the bishop's defense was he said he never read the letter composed by an elementary school principal and teachers at the school on the issue. Here again is a disconnect, profound disconnect.
Huge disconnect. And I understand that, you know, the diocese there, people there, and I actually know a lot of them because I lived in the Kansas City, that diocese, for 17 years before moving back to the East Coast just last year. So the church there is very mature. It was always adult-led and a lot of education. And people there are white-hot angry about this. because in this case, the process is set up by the bishops. The courses that they've required all lay people to go through to recognize odd behavior and signs of abuse and that sort of thing worked. There was this letter was a very well produced and specific letter done by teachers and the principal at a school. So that worked. It's so obvious to everyone where the failure was, that it was at the level of the Chancery Office, of the Vicar General, I think, and the bishop. And then to discover that they had this warning a year ago, they also had other warnings 6 months ago, and these things were ignored. The priest was put into a convent. The bishop was surprised that the priest didn't obey his orders to stay out of areas where there were children. I mean, it's just a rehash of the last 25 years, and at this point people are saying, goodness, how can you at this point be so lax in overseeing this stuff?
And what's the church response to that?
Well, he's appointed a new investigator. He's vowed to increase diligence. He's making everyone sort of redo some of these courses. And I think that a lot of the sentiment is we don't need any more investigators. We have police forces that work perfectly well if they have the information. You know, all the investigators in the world aren't going to work unless you're giving people information that you otherwise have kept secret. So I don't know where this all comes out. There's a great deal of anger and a great deal of distress in the diocese. I don't know, some talk that people will just simply stop giving to diocesan drive that just started. That's all to be seen, but I know that there's a great deal of distress and anger because this is one of those cases that is just so clearly botched at the level of the Chancery Office.
Is it also indicative that in sections of the Church, particularly at the level of local bishops, they're saying that the advice from the Vatican on how to handle these matters, issued only a couple of months ago, is advisory only?
I don't know that that was used in this case. This was not part of that bishop's defense. And you know, it's very clear he came out and took all the blame and the responsibility for this. And he uses those phrases. The question, I guess, lay people have is, well, what does that mean? When you say you take responsibility for these failures, what precisely does it mean? We know what it means in, you know, the business world or the political world. You know, you can vote people out, people get fired or they get demoted. In the case of the episcopacy, as we have seen repeatedly in the United States, it simply means you go on and you hope that it doesn't happen again. So it's a strange circumstance.
The other issue that we share in common, and this is a broad issue of social concern, is the question of illegal immigration, or in Australia's case, refugees coming by boats to Australia. There's been major debates in civil society in Australia over the past couple of weeks on our attitudes to refugees, on our attitudes to people coming illegally on boats. You face it in the United States as a border problem with Mexico, and in many ways the civic response is the same. Tensions between those who wish to protect our society from the hordes who will sweep across the borders. And there's a visceral response here which seems to play into party politics in a very unhealthy way.
Yeah, in the United States, there's really strong unanimity among the bishops on this count. And I think part of it is that much of the population coming across the border from Mexico and Central America is Catholic. But they've been very, very strong and very countercultural in this manner. I've had two interesting experiences in the last month. One was on the border. You know, I was in Tucson going across, back and forth across the border with a group of college students, and at one point we stopped in at a federal court where they were processing illegal immigrant cases, and they did 70, this one judge did 70 in 32 minutes. Impossible to impart justice in that time, but he came down to this group after he was finished on the bench and said, well, I could pontificate about the law and all that sort of thing, but there really aren't many choices. And then he went on to say how absolutely silly he thought the law was, and really encouraged these kids to work for change in the law. He was talking about the need for, you know, worker permits and those kinds of visas that would allow people to go back and forth across the border. The second thing I encountered was a story in Idaho which we don't think of often as one of the mountain states, as a place where there's a great deal of immigration. But 50% of the Catholics, one of the people in the diocese told me, in this diocese of Boise, which covers the whole state, are Catholic. And they found out that immigration was an extremely divisive issue in the churches and parishes. And so this one worker for the diocese put together a program of dialogue, a very disciplined program that really called on the institutional church and its wisdom in doing this sort of thing. And it's had really incredible results. People were really held to a discipline in talking about this issue and held to their own experiences and that sort of thing. And people came out of it. I interviewed a few of them whose minds were changed about this. They may still be opposed to wide open borders, and I think the bishop certainly would be, but they heard what the bishop said, not just what somebody thought about what the bishop said or what they stood for. And they began to hear from immigrants themselves. And it's a really interesting process. So the church, in a lot of ways, is investing an enormous amount of energy and resources in this issue here. And I think there is an example of where, you know, authority hasn't been lost. People are able to listen to it and perhaps even change minds.
Is there broader concern about the way in which the debate has been conducted in the national media? That is, you have some sections of what were previously regarded as the mainstream media tending to exploit right-wing populist sentiment on these issues, stuff that, you know, two generations ago would have been regarded as the province of the John Birch Society, for broad popular appeal. Is the church talking to those opinion leaders as well?
I don't think they're addressing that specifically. You're pointing out a very valid reality in the United States, and that is the enormous shift to the right over the last 40 years in our politics and center of gravity politically. But I don't know that bishops are speaking to that precisely. I think they are looking at their own documents, at papal statements, and the church's doctrine on human rights and positions on human rights, and from the heart of the gospel. This is where we stand. This is what we stand for. There are no illegal people, while at the same time saying, yes, we want to see borders controlled. We don't want, you know, mass crowds coming over the border, but there are ways and systems that we need to put in place to work with 12 million people who are already in the country. You're not going to deport all of them, and let's start talking that way. And I think that has some impact on a lot of people who otherwise would maybe be swayed by the easy popular arguments. People are looking at it more seriously and at a deeper level.
Tom Roberts, great talking to you. Before we let you go, we should say that not only has your contribution to the National Catholic Reporter been valued over the years, but you're about to put out a book in your own right on many of the issues we've been reflecting on. That is, the way in which the Church itself is changing and has changed over the last generation.
Yes, the Emerging Catholic Church, a community in search of itself. And if all goes well, it'll be out in September. Thank you for mentioning it.
Tom Roberts, Editor-at-Large of the National Catholic Reporter. Great to talk with you. We'll catch up again in a month or so, and I'm keen to get a copy of your book, and perhaps we can discuss that in more detail when we have a moment as well. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure as always.